Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, who explains why he views President Bush's illegal surveillance of Americans as a threat to U.S. democracy and an impeachable offense. Anuradha Mittal of the Oakland Institute, who examines why many non-governmental organizations are critical of the agreements reached at the recently concluded World Trade Organization summit meeting in Hong Kong. And Sally Booker, executive director of Africa Action, who reports on the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Darfur, U.S. response, and why he's hopeful that things will improve in the new year. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A year after a massive tsunami ripped through the Indian Ocean basin, over 1.5 million people still lack permanent housing. Hardship for the nearly 2 million people displaced by the tsunami was made worse by monsoons that have swept through East Asia in recent months, forcing people to bail out water on a daily basis. With the flooding comes mosquito infestation and sewage that runs through enclaves of tiny shacks. In Sri Lanka, 78,000 homes were destroyed by the tsunami, but only 5,000 have been rebuilt. In Aceh, Indonesia, land that once housed 120,000 people is now permanently underwater. The World Wildlife Fund is concerned that reconstruction in Aceh will lead to more deforestation and landslides. The tsunami, which killed 170,000 people in Aceh, forced a peace deal between pro-independence rebels and the Indonesian government. But political violence has resumed in Sri Lanka as the Tamil Tigers have renewed their armed campaign. Two Brazilian men were convicted and given harsh sentences for murdering Sister Dorothy Stang, a 73-year-old American-born nun, in the Amazon rainforest on February 12, 2005. Prosecutors say two poor farm workers were paid $25,000 by local landowners to kill Stang, a well-known rainforest defender. For over 20 years, Stang had worked for the Catholic Church's Pastoral Land Commission and was slain in the state of Pará, a place known for corruption, land disputes and violence. Over 530 people were killed in land-related violence there since the mid-1980s, but only 8 killers have been convicted. Two landowners charged with paying for Sister Dorothy's murder are set to go to trial in early 2006. But despite the recent legal proceedings, there is a great fear of violence by rainforest defenders. 51 people are on a landowner hit list, says the Catholic Church's Land Commission. As the Commission's Jack Spinto told the Guardian newspaper, in the state of Pará, the law is still made by those with the most guns. In the rugged highlands of Ethiopia, the birthplace of coffee, peasants pick some of the best-tasting Arabica coffee beans. To bypass the low prices offered by commercial brokers, a growing Ethiopian coffee cooperative movement teamed up with Dean's Beans Coffee Company to promote Aromia blend coffee. In Nicaragua, Dean's Beans set up a special coffee roastery with all the profits going to a charitable prosthetic limb clinic in an agricultural region still plagued by landmines from the Contra War. According to E, the environmental magazine, fair trade and green-labeled coffee has gone mainstream with Starbucks and big roasters like Procter & Gamble seeking to appeal to socially conscious consumers. Moreover, competition has broken out between two rival certification schemes, Fair Trade and the Rainforest Alliance. Fairtrade coffee, which started in Europe in the late 1970s, works to boost the incomes of coffee pickers by supporting cooperatives. Certification of Fairtrade coffee has grown 76% since 2003. The Rainforest Alliance, which devised a strong green certification program for bananas in Central America, has evaluated coffee growers for a decade. The program puts limits on use of agrochemicals and promotes planting native trees and protecting local wildlife. While there's some discussion of developing a more universally accepted certification process, it looks like that for the time being, consumers will have a choice of several green and fair trade coffee labels. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand. Thank you.
The mid-December revelation that President Bush had secretly ordered the National Security Agency to conduct surveillance of international communications involving U.S. residents without obtaining court approval has continued to generate condemnation throughout the Christmas holiday. U.S. District Judge James Robertson, one of 11 members of the secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, resigned from his position on December 19th, confiding in colleagues that the warrantless monitoring of email and phone calls was legally questionable and may have tainted the FISA court. The New York Times, which broke the wiretap story on December 16th, reported on December 23rd that the scope of the monitoring operation is much larger than acknowledged by the White House. The Times reports that the NSA, in cooperation with the nation's largest telecommunications companies, had mined data directly from the main arteries of American communications networks. Many Democrats, joined by some prominent Republicans such as Senators Chuck Hagel of Nebraska and Olympia Snow of Maine, have called for a congressional investigation of the covert electronic eavesdropping program. Michigan Democratic Representative John Conyers has demanded the censure of President Bush and Vice President Cheney, in addition to the creation of a special committee to investigate impeaching the president for his administration's widespread abuse of power. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, who explains why he views President Bush's illegal surveillance of Americans as a grave threat to U.S. democracy and an impeachable offense.
You cannot have a president of the United States who picks and chooses which laws he's going to obey and which laws he's going to flout. And to see him come forward and give a press conference where he says, you know, there was this law, but it was too inconvenient for us to follow. We need to be fast and quick. So we're going to disobey this law because we have this war cloud hanging over us. Well, these are the excuses that any dictator uses. And it's not as though the United States wasn't under grave threat for 35 years and 40 years when the Soviet Union had thousands of ICBMs that could incinerate the United States. That under that justification, any president who needed to be fast and quick, certainly to detect an incoming ICBM, could have ripped up some of the laws that he didn't want to follow. So this is a real problem. I mean, I always thought that Bush could have been impeached for the Iraq War, for launching the war on a leash of lies, for disobeying the UN charter, and then for this torture stuff that was in violation of U.S. law and Geneva Convention against torture. But this spying issue should get more traction because the American people, a vast majority of them, I believe, respect their privacy. I suppose of all the 10 amendments, the fourth one may be the most universally revered. People just don't want the government in their bedroom or on their phone or tapping into their computers. And so I don't see how Bush can get away with this. And the excuses that he's used after the fact, which is to say the Constitution gives him this authority under the Commander-in-Chief provision, or that the authorization of force against Al-Qaeda that Congress issued in October of 2001 gives him that authority. They tried those arguments. That's the amazing thing about this, and no one's really picked up on that. They tried those very two arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court on this question of whether the government could take U.S. citizens, in particular Hamdi, Yasser Hamdi, and put him in solitary confinement and not allow him to go get a trial. And the Supreme Court said no. Sandra Day O'Connor, writing for a majority of the court, said a war does not give the president a blank check to violate the citizen's civil liberties. So they've already tried and lost that argument.
President Bush and other officials in his administration continually try to put politicians on the defensive by saying that the president needs this authority to prevent further terrorist attacks. And of course, with the filibuster against the Patriot Act, the same kind of argument is rolled out, basically saying if there is a terrorist attack in the future, those Democrats or other obstructionists, as the White House calls them, will be held responsible. This certainly creates a bit of fear in a politician's heart, does it not?
It does, and, you know, this card is the card that Bush and Cheney played so aggressively during the campaign in 2004. Vote for us or die was essentially their bumper sticker. If you vote for Kerry, he's not going to protect you from an attack. Now it's, you know, demand that your congressman pass the Patriot Act or you're going to get hit. Allow us to rip up the laws and let the NSA spy on you or you're going to die again. I mean, that really is all they've got left.
Is it working, though? Is it working? Are politicians scared, really, to come out and, use the impeachment threat against this president, who seemingly taste for abusing his power is limitless.
Well, let's leave impeachment aside for one quick second and just look at the distance we've come since the original Patriot Act in the fall of 2001, when there was only one U.S. Senator, Russ Feingold, my senator here from Wisconsin, who voted against the Patriot Act. Now you got a whole bunch of Democrats, enough to filibuster and uphold a filibuster, saying that we don't want this Patriot Act, and some Republicans for that matter. John Sununu from New Hampshire was on board for that, and other Republicans don't like this power grab of the Bush administration. And so I think the climate has changed somewhat, and so I don't think Bush is going to be able to get away with that, though he keeps banging the drums and keeps mentioning 9/11 and another attack. Now, as to impeachment, John Conyers, Democrat from Detroit, is introducing resolutions for impeachment and for an investigation leading up to impeachment. And I've got to think that more and more people at the grassroots are going to put pressure on their legislators, if they are liberal Democrats anyway, to get on board this impeachment bandwagon. Because remember, the Republicans engineered the impeachment of Bill Clinton for something so trivial in comparison to this, which really gets to whether we have a democracy or whether we have a monarchy or dictatorship. I mean, if we look back at the Nixon Watergate fiasco, I mean, early on, people didn't think it was possible that Nixon could be impeached. He had won such a huge landslide in 1972, and 2 years later, the guy was gone. I mean, these things do sometimes take on a momentum of their own, and, you know, you kick over a few rocks and you find a few more worms and snakes, and that's not really good for the administration if that happens. So you never know what's going to crawl out, and in the meantime, there's plenty of stuff that's crawled out already that cries out for a bill of impeachment, and members of the liberal media, liberal mainstream media, are beginning to whisper the I word, and I think those whispers are going to get louder.
That was Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine. Read his McCarthyism Watch commentaries online at www.progressive.org. 3 years ago, the World Trade Organization Ministerial Summit meeting in Cancun, Mexico, collapsed over disagreements between industrial and developing nations regarding the issue of agricultural and other subsidies, payments which critics blame for hurting poor farmers. At the recently concluded WTO summit in Hong Kong, many of these same disagreements were debated and an 11th-hour accord was reached where the U.S. and European Union agreed to cut export subsidies to their farmers by 2013. Developing nations had fought hard for 2010 as the deadline to scrap subsidies, but lost. Throughout the six-day summit meeting, thousands of protesters opposed to the WTO agenda staged demonstrations. As was the case in Cancun, hundreds of Korean farmers traveled to Hong Kong to express their opposition to free trade policies that they say threatens their livelihood. Many of these same farmers were among the 900 who were arrested as they pushed their way into the hall where the WTO was meeting. Many non-governmental organizations from around the globe denounced the Hong Kong agreement, accusing wealthy nations of betraying their promise to reform trade rules to promote development. Critics also warned that proposals to open up non-agricultural markets and service industries in poor nations to international competition would undermine development. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Anuradha Mittal, executive director of the Oakland Institute. She was at the Hong Kong summit and explains why her group and many others oppose the WTO agreements.
The trade negotiators and the ministers were literally meeting in a convention center which looked like a bunker, surrounded by over 30,000 cops, and all because while they were talking about bringing the trade barriers down, they put up these huge barricades to put voices of people who are directly impacted by these decisions out of the convention center. So in the streets, you had farmers. I personally met farmers who I've worked with from Mozambique to Mexico to, you know, to the U.S., to France. But what was most exciting was to see this delegation of about 1,200, 1,300 farmers from Korea who have been challenging these free trade policies, basically, which have removed all kind of tariffs from countries who have opened up borders basically for this dumping of cheap subsidized grains from countries such as the U.S. and the EU, which basically are destroying livelihoods of farmers, as a result of which over 40,000 farmers have taken their own lives in my country, India. Or you look at Korea, where before the start of the ministerial, a young woman farmer took her own life protesting that there is no way that these policies can enable her to continue living on. At the same time, there were people from all walks of life, you know, workers and the local people from Hong Kong to student activists, and especially immigrant rights groups were really present in Hong Kong, all basically trying to change the agenda of this ministerial to put people first before the corporate profit.
What did the countries hammer out in the end when the Hong Kong ministerial meeting ended on the 18th of December?
Yes, the talks did not collapse like they did in Cancun, thanks to the pressure and arm twisting and bribes that were offered by the EU and United States. The third world countries, developing countries, the least developed countries were basically forced into moving this agenda forward. And there's, however, very, very little to celebrate in Hong Kong. I mean, you can just imagine that there's so little of development in this package that they kept having to offer in terms of bribes to developing countries, a thing called development package. Now, the biggest lie of that is the U.S. Trade Representative, for example, was promising money to developing countries, which has not been approved by the Congress. And given how stingy the Congress has been with this, you know, shallow foreign policy, but also with the deficit, we know it is not about to happen. Japan, in the name of development package, basically offered concessional loans in name of aid for trade. Now, these loans are going to put these third world countries further into debt. EU promised money, which actually does not exist, and it has already promised that money before. So you saw a lot of talk, a lot of rhetoric around development. But at the end, you had a lot of pressure being put on third world countries and arm twisting.
I know one of the major issues that was on the table in Hong Kong was the ending of subsidies, particularly agricultural subsidies.
Well, Scott, as you just mentioned, agriculture has been one of the most contentious issues in these talks, and many people are celebrating like, oh, they have finally agreed, the European Union, to eliminate export subsidies by the end of 2013. Now, first of all, that date is really late. Now, as I mentioned, people are committing suicide. Farmers are killing themselves, taking their own lives because they have no market for their crops. They have gone into debt, and then suddenly their markets have been flooded by cheap imports from the EU and the US because it is subsidized. So first of all, it should have happened. These should have been eliminated earlier. But secondly, let's look at, for example, cotton, which has been very much in the news. Countries, especially in Africa, have been devastated by subsidized cotton coming in from, again, U.S. So the whole focus in terms of cotton is to remove the export subsidies by 2006. Now, the problem is that these export subsidies constitute a very small portion of the trade distortion. So there is no agreement on actually getting rid of trade-distorting domestic subsidies, which amount to basically 80 to 90% of the total U.S. support for cotton. In the case of EU, domestic subsidies make up almost all of the cotton subsidies. So basically, we have just, you know, paid lip service to the issue of subsidies. The third world countries were told and made to believe that you've gotten a great deal in agriculture, but in reality, they haven't gotten anything as far as agriculture is concerned. At the same time, the worst thing that has happened is in terms of services. There's a thing called GATS, the Agreement on Services, and suddenly when the Hong Kong ministerial was being held, the draft of the ministerial that came from Geneva had a thing called Annex C. Annex C basically takes away the ability of developing countries to figure it out within the country if they're willing to negotiate on a certain service offer from, say, EU or the U.S. And this takes it away, that ability to make the request and for the third world countries to say no. That was attached without the consensus. In Hong Kong, we saw over 90 developing countries object to that Annex C, and at the end of the ministerial, they had agreed to it. Basically, that was a demand of the EU. I mean, if I get rid of all this trade jargon, the end message is developing countries walked away with nothing. They got nothing. The only situation they have is a lose-lose situation, whereas for the EU and US, it's only a win-win situation for the corporations. So I think we as international community have to stand up, and especially in the US, exercise the power of the fact that we are in the United States, which is one of the countries that is kind of you know, providing the charge to this very undemocratic anti-development agenda.
That was Anuradha Mittal, Executive Director of the Oakland Institute. Contact the Institute by calling area code 510-469-5228 or visit their website at www.oaklandinstitute.org. In December, U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice urgently requested that Congress provide $50 million to support the African Union Observer Mission in Darfur, Sudan. But the GOP-controlled Congress declined. The $50 million would have funded about one-third of the monthly cost for the peacekeepers. The European Union has provided most of the remainder. Since a Darfur rebel group began fighting the Central Sudanese government in 2003, up to 200,000 black Africans have been killed by the Sudanese government or their allied Janjaweed Arab militia. During the conflict, an estimated 200,000 people in Darfur have died due to the lack of food, water, and basic health care. Another 2.5 million have become internally displaced, and 200,000 to 300,000 are living as refugees in neighboring Chad. Those who have been displaced, both inside and outside the country, are totally dependent on international aid. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Sally Booker, Executive Director of Africa Action, about the current situation in Darfur, the U.S. response, and why he's hopeful that things will improve in the new year.
Sadly, the Congress, nor the administration, quite frankly, has simply placed that much of a priority on ending the genocide in Darfur. There's a lot of rhetoric on the subject, but in terms of taking the practical steps necessary to provide protection for the several million people in Darfur who are completely vulnerable to the ongoing violence, they just haven't taken the practical steps. And so the fact that the State Department asked for this money and Congress didn't provide it simply reveals that both sides had other priorities and neither side made it an urgent matter. And that $50 million would have represented only about a third of the monthly costs of the observer mission that's about somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000 troops right now.
Has the African Union mission been effective at all in minimizing the violence?
The force has been helpful in the limited areas where it is in providing some security to the large numbers of internally displaced people. But it doesn't have a mandate for protection. It doesn't have a mandate for peace enforcement or peacekeeping. It is simply an observer mission. So the demand right now of the people in Darfur and supporters around the world is to turn that African Union force into a UN blue-helmeted peacekeeping operation and give it a mandate to protect civilians and give it reinforcements, i.e. troops from other countries willing to contribute, including other African countries, but also countries outside of Africa. There already is a UN peacekeeping operation in southern Sudan that has some 4,000 troops from countries around the world, and it's also been suggested some of that force could be relocated in Darfur where the urgency is much greater. The violence is ongoing, and there's a greater need for physical protection. The violence has not really been influenced so much by the presence of AU observers as by the decisions of the Sudanese government. In other words, in the first part of this genocide, if you will, the government slaughtered some 400,000 people, half of them directly in violence, the other half because of the conditions created, died due to disease or starvation. There are now 2.5 million people in these camps for internally displaced people.
Sally Booker, do you think the Bush administration is doing anything right since Condi Rice strongly pushed for that $50 million in aid?
I think the problem with the Bush administration is that rhetorically it has made these bold pronouncements. It acknowledged that genocide was occurring in Sudan over a year ago, But then it's failed to act. It's failed to show the courage of its convictions. It hasn't provided any real international leadership at the UN Security Council when it's had an opportunity. So we've been pushing for the U.S. to provide that leadership that's needed to get a resolution to have a United Nations Chapter 7 peacekeeping operation. That would be a mandate to protect civilians, to use force if necessary, and such a mandate could be given to the AU, which would then become an expanded UN operation. We believe, finally, the Bush administration may use February, when the U.S. chairs the Security Council, as an opportunity to introduce and gain passage for such a resolution. And that's what our activities have been focusing on.
How much do you think the issue of Darfur has really penetrated Americans' consciousness?
There are thousands of people around the country that are writing letters to their own editors of local papers, because this has been one of the strategies of the movement to end genocide in Darfur, is to get local media to pay greater attention. So I would say, comparatively, there has been a high level of attention to Darfur on the part of print media and editorial boards. Less so in the case of the mainstream television news. You have in the United States a very strong interest in Darfur on the part of a really broad and eclectic constituency, everyone from evangelical Christians to the Jewish community to African Americans involved in political activism. Students have really taken up this challenge of working to end the genocide in Darfur and what the U.S. appropriate role should be. But in the final analysis, there hasn't been enough pressure to get the politicians to do what's absolutely necessary, and that's simply because they just don't think it's as much a priority as it should be, which is highly contradictory given this acknowledgement publicly that genocide is taking place.
That was Sally Booker of Africa Action. Contact the group at area code 202-546-7961. Or visit the group's website at www.africaaction.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Todd. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.